For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It's December the 7th when Parshas Tetzav. We're on page 480, but we have at least one loose end tie up from last time. At the end of last week's class, we had a question about kapara, about atonement. And we said we would touch on it this week. I don't know if we'll cover it completely, but at least we'll broaden the discussion a little bit. We know there's such a thing called mechila. Mechila means to be forgiven for a sin. And then there is kapara, which is atonement. They're really two different things. Mechila, which is to be forgiven, is that Hashem accepts a person's teshuva, and the person now has all of the privileges of being a person who is a tzaddik. A tzaddik is a person who does mitzvos and doesn't do averos. And there's a big difference between a person being a tzaddik and not being a tzaddik. For example, the Rambam writes that the davening of a person who is not a tzaddik is not accepted by Hashem, whereas the davening of a tzaddik is accepted by Hashem. That's a big difference, that your davening is accepted by Hashem. And as soon as a person does teshuva for his averos, for his sins, and Hashem gives him mechila, he forgives him, the person is a tzaddik. But that's not the same thing as kapara. Kapara, which means atonement, is the wiping away of the sin. That would be the cleansing of the sin. That, because a sin also affects a person. It muddies their record, so to speak. And atonement, kapara, gets rid of the avera completely. Tshuva, when a person does teshuva, that can also attain kapara, but that's a higher level. It's a lower level just to get mechila, to get forgiveness. Kapara, which is atonement, is a higher level, and it requires more to get to completely remove the sin. Sometimes suffering is required in order to achieve kapara, atonement. That means even if a person had mechila, had forgiveness, they still might need some sort of yisurin, of suffering for kapara, for atonement. Obviously we wish not, but that could be the case. One way that kapara was achieved when we had a Beis HaMikdash was to bring a karban. To bring a karban was a way of achieving kapara, atonement. And we learned back in Parshas Bereishis, all the way back in the beginning, when Hashem is ready to create man. So it says, if you want to see it, it's on page 10. On page 10, when it's describing in more detail the creation of man, this is after the 6 days of creation. In the 6 days of creation, there's a brief description of the creation of man. And here, in Perek Beis, in chapter 2, there's a broader description. So it says in Pasuk Zion, verse 7, Vayitzer Hashem Elokim et ha'adam, Hashem formed man or created man, afar min ha'adama. Afar means
dust
or dirt. Min ha'adama, from
the earth.
From the earth. Okay. So dust from the earth. Ha'adama. The definite article. From the earth. Sounds like a specific type of earth was used to create man. What is that specific type of earth? So Rashi offers two explanations. Rashi says, I will translate it as I go. Rashi says he gathered dirt from all the land, from all four directions. He gathered dirt. So in other words, man was created from not dirt from one place on earth, but from all directions of the earth, so that wherever man would die, the land would accept his body for burial. That it shouldn't reject his body, because we know that when you put a foreign substance into something, it can be rejected. And since man is made from dirt, that's why man is able to be buried. But Hashem wanted it to be that a man could die anywhere and be buried anywhere and not have the threat of rejection from the earth, and therefore he used dirt from all four directions of the land. That's one explanation. But the second explanation, Rashi says, is he took the dirt from the place where it says Mizbach Adama Ta'aseli, an altar of Adama, of dust, of dirt, of land, you shall make for me. Hashem took the dirt that he used to create man, he took it from the place of the Mizbeach, of the altar. Why? Why did Hashem specifically use the dirt from the Makom HaMizbeach, from the place of the altar, as the dirt with which he created man? Because Halavai Tehelo Kapara, because it should be that he should have an atonement, the Yuchol Lamod, he should be able to stand. Hashem formed us using dirt from the place of the Mizbeach, of the altar, so that we would be predisposed for kapara, for atonement. That which the Mizbeach does for us, we should be very relatable to it, to the dirt of the Mizbeach. So you see that in the very creation of man, this goal of achieving kapara, of achieving atonement, was foremost in what Hashem did. That our very being, our very bodies are made of the stuff that kapara comes from, that atonement comes from. Knowing that man is human and therefore does sin, it was critical that we be able to achieve kapara, atonement. And that's why the dirt was taken from there. Now, this, first of all, underscores what we said last week, that we talked about Kodesh Kadashim, Holy of Holies, and we pointed out that there's really two different Kodesh Kadashim. There is the one that we all know about, which is the inner sanctuary, where the Aron, where the Ark is, but then there's also the Mizbeach, the altar is also called Kodesh Kadashim. Now, we know that Hashem created the world using the Evan Shesia. The Evan Shesia, which is the foundational stone of the world, that was what Hashem used to create the world. He started with that stone, and from there the rest of the world was created. It's possible that the stone that is located, the Evan Shesia is supposed to be in the Makom HaMikdash, where the Beis HaMikdash is. And when the Gemara tells us, the Mishnah tells us, that in the first Beis HaMikdash, in the first temple, in the Kodesh Kadashim, in the Holy of Holies, was located the Aron, was located the Ark, and that's where, when the Kohen Gadol would go in on Yom Kippur, and he would sprinkle the blood, it would be there where the Ark was, where the Aron was. In the second Beis HaMikdash, in the second temple, there was no ark. So what was there instead? So the Mishnah says, there was a stone there, and it's Shesia HaYasa Nikres. It was called the Evan Shesia. The Shesia stone, the foundational stone of the world, was located in the Kodesh HaKadashim. And that was where the Aron would have been. If they would have had an ark in the second temple, that's where it would have been. As an aside, is that the stone around which the Dome of the Rock is built? Perhaps yes, perhaps no. I don't know. The stone around which the Dome of the Rock is built, I've seen pictures of it. It's a very, very large stone. as big as a whole room. It's a very big stone. So I don't know if that is accurate or not. I don't know. But there, in the second Mesamech, the second temple, there was a stone there, which was the Evan Shesia, the foundational stone. So one second. So in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the Holy of Holies, you have this stone from which the world was created. At the Mizbeach, at the altar, you also, which is also called Kodesh Kadashim, Holy of Holies, like we discussed last time, you have the dirt from which man was created. So here you find the dual aspect we spoke about last week of Kodesh Kadashim, of Holy of Holies, that you have one Holy of Holies that is the inner sanctuary where the ark rested, and then you have the Mizbeach, which also is a Kodesh Kadashim. We talked about the dual aspect of it. One was from where the world was created. The other is from where man was created. The whole world was only created for man. The whole purpose of the world is for man. And man is created from the Mizbeach. So these dual aspects of Kodesh Kadashim are reflected in what was created from the substance that the Kodesh Kadashim of each of these Holy of Holies was situated around. Now we have questions.
Just a quick. The Emshia, it was in the second Beis Hamikdash, right?
They did, because they didn't have the Aron, they didn't have the Ark.
But what I want to know is, was this Emshia also in the first Beis Hamikdash?
I assume it was there in the first Beis Hamikdash, but it wasn't necessary to know that because they had the Aron.
Gotcha.
I'm assuming it was there as well.
Okay. Can you spell that?
Shesia is Shin,
uh-huh.
Saf, Yud, Hey.
Okay.
Right.
Do we assume that Hashem does forgive us whenever you
do teshuva?
Do
teshuva. Oh, yes. I mean, on Yom Kippur, the day itself, anybody who treats Yom Kippur as if it is Yom Kippur and doesn't ignore the fact that it's Yom Kippur is automatically forgiven on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is a day of forgiveness. The day itself brings with it forgiveness. But there's different levels. So forgiveness is transforming a person from being a rasha, God forbid, to being a tzaddik. It's the greater levels of that, which include kapara, atonement, which it depends on the person, depends on how much teshuva they do, etc. But it has to be emphasized that the being transformed to a tzaddik cannot be underscored, how understated, how great it is. It is a completely different existence to be a tzaddik. And that Yom Kippur affords to everybody who treats it as Yom Kippur. This is why I feel that when Yom Kippur is over, Motzai Yom Kippur, and the next thing you do after Yom Kippur is over is we daven Ma'ariv. Now women aren't required to daven Ma'ariv, but the shul davens Ma'ariv, and men have to daven Ma'ariv after Yom Kippur is over. And a lot of people leave after Yom Kippur is over. They don't stay for Ma'ariv. So if the women are leaving, and because they have obligations at home, so that's a good reason to leave. That's just as much of a mitzvah as davening Ma'ariv, if that's why a woman is leaving. But for a man to leave and not to daven Ma'ariv, or for a man to rush through Ma'ariv, I always feel it's such a wasted opportunity, because at that moment we're all tzaddikim. It doesn't matter where we were before, we're now, anybody who's in shul, who recognizes Yom Kippur as Yom Kippur, is a tzaddik, which means that now there's no question that our davening is accepted by Hashem, without question. So if there's ever a davening where one should pour out everything they've got, it would be the first Ma'ariv after Yom Kippur, because that's the one in which you know for a fact you're a tzaddik. After that, who knows what goes on? After that, right? Nobody knows what's going to happen after that. But that moment, you haven't spoken any Lashon Hara yet. You haven't eaten without a bracha. Everything's been done. You're good. You're totally... So who wants to give up that davening? It's such a special time to daven. It pains me when people don't treat it with... Because it's such a special time. But that's just mechila. That's being forgiven. Atonement, kapara, is a higher level, and just because a person got mechila doesn't necessarily mean they got kapara. Kapara is a higher level.
Okay. If you're not, like, sometimes, you know, you may not even know that you've sinned or whatever. So if you're really not a tzaddik and your davening isn't accepted, what's the point?
In every Shemona Esrei we have a bracha of Slach Lanu Avinu.
Right.
Forgive us. So we daven to Hashem to forgive us in every Shemona Esrei. So if a person is davening Shemona Esrei sincerely, they're saying it. Mm-hmm. Part of that is, even if I don't know if I did an Avera, please forgive me. That's valid. That's a valid. That's, you know, Yom Kippur is more powerful. But a sincere person is going to be davening all the time, and included in that is asking for forgiveness. Rabbeinu Yonah writes that part of the reason why we say Slach Lanu in every Shemona Esrei is because we don't know if we've sinned. Sometimes we don't remember. We don't know. And so we have to ask to make sure we get forgiven. Yeah. Now, one other loose end before we move forward in Parashas Tetzaveh is that the Torah says that it's a 7-day process for Aaron to be inaugurated as the Kohen, for the Mizbeach to be inaugurated, for his children to be inaugurated. It takes 7 days. The Gemara derives not from here, but from when the Psukim, this whole, here in Parashas Tetzaveh is where Moshe Rabbeinu is being told what will happen at the inaugural process of the Mishkan. The actual process is described in Parashas Tzav and Shemini. Vayihi Bayom Hashmini was on the 8th day. That's the day after these 7 days. And these 7 days are described at the end of the previous parasha, Parashas Tzav. So we'll be getting to that. It's not so far further in where we're up to now, although at the rate that we go, it'll be a little while before we get there. Over there in Parashas Tzav, where the Torah describes these 7 days of miluim, of the inaugural process, the Gemara derives that there are two other things that require a 7-day preparatory phase. 7 days to prepare for something. Besides here, which are 7 days to prepare to become the Kohen Gadol, become the Kohanim, to inaugurate the Mizbeach, there are two other things that require a 7-day preparation. One is before Yom Kippur. The Kohen Gadol is separated for 7 days. 7 days prior to Yom Kippur, he goes to the Beit HaMikdash and he actually sets up his lodging in a room off of the Beit HaMikdash. That's where he lives for the 7 days prior to Yom Kippur. That's not just some form of pragmatic training. That's because the Torah requires a 7-day preparatory phase before the Yom Kippur service. That's one. Two is before being involved with the Para Aduma, with the ashes of the red heifer, meaning to make a new one. You know that the ashes of the Para Aduma, of the red heifer, lasted for many, many years. The one Para Aduma, it's a cow is a very large animal. And besides that, the ashes that are collected after it, with the process of the Parah Aduma, as we will learn later on, Mirtz Hashem, is the animal is slaughtered, not in the Beis HaMikdash, it's on a mountain outside the Beis HaMikdash, the animal is slaughtered, and then the animal is completely burned. All of the ashes from that burning process, including the fuel that's used, the wood that's used to burn the Parah Aduma, all of those ashes are collected. And those ashes are used to purify a person or utensils who have become impure because of coming in contact with a dead body. Those ashes last a long time because what happens is they take some of those ashes and mix them with water when you're about to use it. You don't just sprinkle the ashes. When you have a group of people that need this purification, they take water, they take some ashes, mix them together, and that water with the ashes mixed in is what's sprinkled. So imagine all those, you know, the ashes from all that huge animal, and then you mix it with water as you need it. It lasts a very, very, very long time, and it doesn't spoil. It just lasts. They keep it in a container, and it goes for a long, long period of time. Periodically, they'd have to make a new Parah Aduma. They'd run out of ashes, and they'd have to make a new Parah Aduma. So as it was necessary, they would do new ones. And the Gemara describes how many were done in the second Beis HaMikdash as they needed them. So when the Kohen is going to be involved in making a new paradum, which means taking a new cow and slaughtering it and going through the whole process, there's a 7-day preparatory stage where he is involved in preparing for the Parah Adumah. So the Gemara connects the Miluim, the inauguration of the Mizbeach and the Kohanim, Yom Kippur, and the Parah Adumah. These three processes are linked together, that they all share the requirement of a 7-day preparatory phase. I don't think that we need to delve too deeply to figure out why those things would be connected. They all involve the Kohanim, and they all involve an elevated level of purity, the obviously becoming Kohanim, and the Mizbeach becoming the Mizbeach. That's clearly a level of purity that's elevated. Yom Kippur, how can we question that level of elevated level of purity? And then the Parah Adumah, which is meant to purify everybody as well from the most difficult tumah, the most difficult impurity to rid oneself of. So it makes sense that these things require this preparatory stage. Now, we also had another thing that had a preparatory stage of 7 days.
The oil.
The oil of?
Hanukkah.
Oil of Hanukkah. Well,
7 days to get
new oil. It took 8 days to get the new oil. Okay, good. You have Hanukkah on your mind, which is a good thing to have in your mind right now. That's good. That's good. What do you say? Tzaras? Tzaras to get rid of the tzaras. That's not a preparatory stage, right? Right. But we had it in Chumash. We had a 7-day preparatory stage. It was a debate exactly how to understand when these 7 days happened, but if you look at the end of Parashas Mishpatim, where the Torah recounts the story of the giving of the Torah, page 442, Pasuk Tes Zayin, verse 16, it says, Vayishkon Kvod Hashem al Har Sinai, and the honor of Hashem, or the, what do they call it? The
glory
of Hashem, thank you, rested on Har Sinai. Vayichaseu ha'anon sheishes yomim, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. Vayikra el Moshe bayom ha'shvi'i mitoch ha'anon, and he called to Moshe on the 7th day from inside the cloud. There is a debate at the time when we read these psukim, we learned the debate. There's a debate whether these are referring to the days prior to the Aseres HaDibros, prior to the Ten Commandments, from Rosh Chodesh Sivan until the 7th day of Sivan, if that's the 7 days that are being referred to here, or if this is the first 7 days following the Aseres HaDibros, following the Ten Commandments, that before, when Moshe went up for 40 days to get the rest of the Torah, the first 7 were spent outside of the cloud, preparing to enter into the cloud, and then Hashem called Moshe on the 7th day to enter. So here as well, we find a similar process where there is a waiting period. It is a little bit different because here it seems to be it was really 6 days, and on the 7th day Moshe enters, where what we've been describing is 7 days, and it's on the 8th day that the preparatory stage is over. So that's slightly different. But again, you see the need for the preparatory phase prior to the awesome, the awesome experience of receiving the Torah. Susan. At the very least, we should take out of here the fact that we shouldn't underestimate the need to prepare for something important. Sometimes something important is going to happen, and we might prepare. We prepare physically, like we'll prepare if there for Yontif, we'll prepare meals and clothing and cleanliness of the house and things like that. And we prepare, which is good. We're supposed to do that. But there is a preparation that is also getting oneself ready spiritually for the experience that's going to happen. We shouldn't underestimate the benefit of that preparation and really the need for it. A person who goes into something sublime without preparing for it, they may have the experience, but they certainly don't have the experience the same way as someone who prepares for it in advance. And if as the Torah describes, preparation for accepting the Torah, preparation for Yom Kippur, preparation for the inauguration of the Kohen, preparation for the Parah Aduma, it would do us well to see if we can also prepare when needed for big things as they happen in our lives. The preparation for it is critical in order to fully gain from the experience. Yeah.
The Torah spends a lot of time going over what Moshe is supposed to teach Aaron and his sons, right? Is this going to be repeated when Mashiach comes?
And that's a very good question.
Because it's a lot of specific
things
that we're not going to do again.
Right. Let's answer the question one at a time. The first question is this going to happen when Mashiach comes? It would seem that it won't happen exactly this way. It may happen in some sort of similar way. There may be something like this. We will find later on that every Kohen, on the day that he starts his service in the Beis HaMikdash, when he gets old enough to start for the first time, there is a ceremony. There is a carbon that he brings. And the Kohen Gadol has to do it every day. Not the same things we described over here, but there is going to be a carbon that is offered by new Kohanim as they enter the priesthood, and the Kohen Gadol every day. So we do find at least the idea conceptually, and it will not be surprising if something similar happens with the third Beis HaMikdash. We do find described by Yechezkel, you do find description of various karbanos that are done to initiate things. But your broader question is, let's say this was never done again, will never be done again. It was only that one time. So this happened over 3,000 years ago, and that's it. So the Torah spends a lot of time telling us about it, and it's not just a story, but it's actually a bunch of laws that the Torah tells us about, and they are not relevant necessarily to us. So here you have to deal with what the Gemara says about parts of the Torah that don't seem relevant. The first thing is, a lot of it is much more relevant than we think. A lot of it is much more relevant, even if it appears to be not so relevant, but the cases do come up more often than we expect them to. But something which really isn't relevant, and the classic examples of that are what the Gemara says, the mitzvah of the ben sorer umore, the wayward son, that's one, and the mitzvah of the ir hanidachas, where the entire city becomes idolatrous. So the description of what you're supposed to do in those cases, there is a strong opinion in the Gemara that both these cases, lo haya v'lo asid lios, it never happened and will never happen. So it's even better than this case. This case, at least, we know happened. Those cases, which are also laws in the Torah, there is a very strong opinion in the Gemara that says it never happened and will never happen. So the Gemara says, "Im kein lama nechtav." So why was it written? It's your question. So why write it down? And the Gemara answers a very cryptic answer: Drosh v'kabel schar. Drosh means expound upon it and receive reward. Expound upon it and receive reward. So what does that mean? Expound upon it and receive reward. So some commentaries want to say that just means that there is a value to the study of Torah, even when it's not relevant, because the study of Torah is a mitzvah, and it's the greatest of all mitzvahs, and therefore, even if it doesn't have any relevance, never happened, never will happen, it's part of the Torah, expound upon it, you will receive the same reward as the rest of the Torah. That's one approach. But that's not Rashi's approach. Rashi tells us that what it means is you can derive lessons from it, even though it may never have happened and will never happen. But one can still derive a lot of many lessons about how we are supposed to behave or how we are supposed to understand things based on the commandments of the Torah, even the ones that never happened and will never happen. with the miluim, I believe that is the case. Because, again, as we've mentioned the past couple of weeks, it's hard for us to appreciate the miluim fully, since this is our first exposure to, we'll call it, heavy-duty karbonos, right? This is like immersion in karbonos. This is our first real experience with it. And you know, we had the Karbon Pesach, but that wasn't nearly as detailed as this is. And it's hard for us to appreciate the nuances that are going on over here compared to other karbonos. But those nuances will likely inform the other karbonos. We'll be able to derive that, well, the regular chatas doesn't have what the miluim had. Why is that? And then from that comparison, it may teach us something about a regular chatas, a regular sin offering, things of that nature. So I don't pretend to know all of this, but there is certainly what to derive and learn from the commandments over here. Which brings us back to, really, and I appreciate you bringing this up, it brings us back to that which has been bothering everybody since we started this discussion, which is, well, okay, this is all the what, but why? Why is this what the Torah commands? Why this, why that? And I kept saying to you, right now we're involved in the what, but we're not involved in the why. I'm not ready yet to go back to the whys, and I, truth be told, I'm not sure that it's valuable to do at this stage at all. Meaning, it may only be valuable for us to do that once we get to regular karbonos in Parshas Vayikra. I'm still debating in my own mind about whether to do that now. But certainly not ready just yet. I certainly want to do the next paragraph, which is on page 480, before we would do any other whys.
Actually, when we learn this, like we did it.
That's true too. That's true too. The Gemara says when you learn the parts of the Torah, it's like you are performing them. You're given a reward like you actually did the mitzvah. That is true too. Yeah. Okay, so we don't have that much time left this evening, but I'd like to at least do this one paragraph on page 480. Laman Ches 38. That's what we're up to. Here we will have a description of the Karban Tamid, of the daily offering, the one that was offered every single day. Once in the morning, once in the afternoon. Every single day that the Mizbeach existed, we had to bring a Karban Tamid. That means it started with the construction of the Mishkan, and it went on every single day, all the way through till the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. So we're talking about a period of approximately 900 years, where every single day they would bring two karbanos, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. This is on top of any other karbanos anybody brought, but these had to be brought. So here we have the first time the Torah describes it. It will be described again in more detail in Parshas Pinchas, which is quite a ways away from where we're up to. So the Torah says, "V'zeh asher ta'aseh al mizbeach." This is what you shall do on the mizbeach. Now that we're dealing with an inaugurated mizbeach, so this is what you need to do on it. Kivasim b'nei shana, sheep, a year old sheep. Shnayim layom tamid, two per day, constantly, consistently, meaning every single day, two per day. As takeves ha'echad ta'aseh b'boker, one sheep you shall do in the morning. Ve'eis takeves ha'sheni ta'aseh b'in ha'arvayim, and one, the second one, you shall do in the afternoon. Now, along with the sheep, we need to bring nisachim. Nisachim literally means libations, but it's not only libations. With every karbon, I should say, typically with a karbon, is brought flour, oil, and wine. So that's described here as well. V'isaron soles, one isaron of flour, and isaron literally means a tenth. So it's a tenth of an epha, and we'll describe what that is once we have a chance to. We'll describe the measurements. I'm not sure we'll do that this evening, but we will describe what the measurements are at some point in the near future. So, one-tenth of flour, that's fine flour, balul b'shemen kassis, mixed up with pure oil, that's olive oil, Reva hahin, how much oil? A quarter of a hin. A hin would be the liquid measure, the liquid volume, and a quarter of that volume is what would be needed for the oil. V'nesach and a libation, revias hahin yayin, also a quarter of a hin of wine, lakeves ha'echad, for the one sheep. We will see later on that depending on the animal, whether it's a sheep or a goat or a bull, the amount of flour, oil, and wine varied. It increased with the size of the animal. The sheep being the smallest of the animals, I'm sorry, not a goat, ram. Sheep, ram, and ram meaning also a male sheep but an adult sheep, and a bull, the sizes increased as the animal size increased. So here you have the smallest size, which is 1/10, 1 isaron of flour, and then a quarter of a hin of both oil and wine. Ve'eis ha-keves ha-she'it ha-aseh bein ha-arbayim, and the second sheep should be done in the afternoon. Kimincha's ha-boker u'chenizka ta'aseh la, like the mincha is the flour offering, like the mincha of the morning and like its libations you shall do for it. So the same flour, the same oil, the same wine. The flour would be the mincha, the oil and the wine would be the nesachim, the libations. L'reach nichach, as a pleasant, literally means a pleasant smell, which means a pleasant smell for Hashem, meaning he doesn't have a nose or anything. We described this before. It means that it's pleasant to Hashem that we listen to him. Yishela Hashem, it is a fire offering to Hashem. Now, what kind of carbon is this? It just says to bring the carbon. It doesn't say, is it an ola, totally burnt? Is it a chatas? Is it a sin offering? What is it exactly? So the next pasuk says, olas tamid l'doro seichem, it is a consistent or constant ola, completely burnt offering for all your generations. Pesach oel moed lifnei Hashem, at the doorway of the Mishkan in front of Hashem. Asher ivaid lachem shama, where I will meet with you there, meaning in the Mishkan, I, Hashem, will meet with you, Moshe, there. L'darei lech Hashem, to speak to you there. That's the place where I'm going to speak to you, which is in the Mishkan, and that is where this carbon should be done. V'noadati shama livnei Yisrael, and I will meet there, or I will be known there to the children of Israel. V'nikdash bichvodi, and it shall be sanctified with my glory. It, the Mishkan, will be sanctified with my glory. We're going to come back to those two words in just a moment. We're going to finish the paragraph and come back to those two words. V'kidashti es oel moed, and I will sanctify the Mishkan, the es hamizbeach, and the altar. V'es Aaron v'es banav, and Aaron and his sons, akadesh, I will sanctify l'chahen li, to be kohanim for me. V'shachanti besoch b'nei Yisrael, I will dwell amongst the Jewish people. V'yayisi lahem le'lokim, and I will be for them as a God. V'yadu, and you will know, ki ani Hashem Elokeihem, that I am Hashem their God. Asher hotzeisi osam eretz Mitzrayim, that I took them out of Egypt. Lishachni v'socham, so that I dwell among them. Why did I take them out of Egypt? So that I shall dwell among them. Ani Hashem Elokeihem, I am Hashem their God. Hashem is standing very clearly over here. Taking us out of Egypt was for the purpose of dwelling among us. Hashem wants to dwell among us. That's why he took us out of Egypt. And there was no other purpose in taking us out of Egypt. And therefore, it is critical that we live up to that goal, because that's what Hashem wanted all along in taking us out of Egypt. Going back to those two words that I emphasized for you, back in Pasuk Mem Gimel 43, where the end of the Pasuk is, V'nikdash bichvodi, I will become sanctified, it will become sanctified with my glory. The Gemara says, don't read it bichvodi, with my glory, but rather bimichubadi, or bimichubadai, with those who glorify me. It, the Mishkan, will become sanctified with those who glorify me. Later on in Parashas Shemini, when the two sons of Aaron are going to die, Nadav and Avihu, and Moshe Rabbeinu will say to Aaron that he will say to Aaron, in fact, you know what, let's look at the pasuk, because it's very powerful when you actually see it inside. Hold the place here and turn ahead the Parasha Shmini. Page 592. After Nadav and Avihu are killed because they offer something that they offer an offering they shouldn't do. So in Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, after they die, Moshe is now going to console Aaron. Vayomer Moshe al Aaron, Moshe said to Aaron, Hu asher diber Hashem leimar. This is what Hashem meant when he said, Bikrovai ekadesh, that with my close ones, I will become sanctified. Those who are nearest to me, I'll become sanctified. Va'apenechol ha'am ekaved, and on the face of the entire nation, I will be honored. Vayidom Aaron, Aaron was quiet. Now we're going to discuss this at great length, please God, when we get there. But Moshe Rabbeinu says to Aaron, this is what God meant when he said that I will be sanctified through those who are closest to me. The Gemara asks, when did Hashem say that? Moshe is saying, now we know what Hashem meant. Hashem said, I will become sanctified with those closest to me. And you know what it meant? It meant through your sons who were killed, Hashem is sanctified. And now we know what he meant. But what was Moshe Rabbeinu talking about? What words were undefined until Aaron's sons died? So our sages tell us, the Gemara says, these two words, v'nichdash bichvodi, back on page 480, it will become sanctified through my glory. So don't read it through my glory, but through those who glorify me. That I, Hashem, am sanctified through those who glorify me. Nadav and Avihu glorified me. I became sanctified through them. Now, the depths of Nadav and Avihu being a sanctification of God's name needs explanation. And especially since it didn't have to happen. They could have made the right choice instead of the wrong choice and not been killed. So in what way would Hashem's name have been sanctified? If this means that Hashem's name is sanctified through the deaths of Nadav and Avihu, what if they wouldn't have died? What if they would have done the right thing and not died? Then how would Hashem's name have been sanctified? So we have to answer, how is it that his name is sanctified, number one, and number two, what if they wouldn't have died? So when we get there, Mirz Hashem, we will learn about this, about how their deaths sanctified God's name, and if they wouldn't have died, what would have been the alternative? How would God's name have been sanctified without their deaths? For now, rather than get into that now, we just want to point out that here, these two words, that it, the Mishkan, will become sanctified through my glory, and the double way of reading it, that I will be sanctified through those who glorify me, that this is the what Moshe Rabbeinu was referring to later on when Aaron's sons die. So these two words are very powerful. When you read it here, it's very easy to miss it. It seems like it's just, you know, just more words that are talking about the sanctification of the Mishkan, but in fact, it is referring to the eventual deaths of the sons of Aaron. So when we get there, Mitzvah Hashem, Parsha Shmini, we're going to refer back to over here. Hopefully, we will all still remember this at that time. Right? Mechubadi, those who glorify me. It might be Mechubadai. There are no vowels. Mechubadai would be plural. Mechubadi would be singular. So I'm not sure which one.
Mixing flour, oil, and wine causes good aroma?
So the Gemara says it doesn't literally mean it smells good. It means it causes what is equivalent to us, what we feel when we have a good aroma that we smell. That's kiviyachol, so to speak, the way what is happening when we do something that Hashem appreciates that we did what he asked us to do.
Do we know why Hashem wanted those three things?
You're asking the why. The flour, oil, and wine accompany most karbanos. Most karbanos have with them flour, oil, and wine along with the karban.
Okay.
So, You want more than that? Hopefully we'll discuss that further when we get to Parshas Vayikra.
Because I won't remember that I...
No, you'll remember. You'll see. We're going to get to... Once we get to Parshas Vayikra, Karbanos are going to be front and center for a while. We'll have to really discuss them. Now, the Karban Tamid, the constant daily sacrifice, is what defines the Mizbeach. You see that as soon as we have the inauguration of the Mizbeach, the next thing the Torah says is that this is what's going to be done every day. And you know that one of the things for which we fast when we get to Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, one of the things for which we fast in the summertime is Batla Hatamid, that the Karban Tamid was stopped.
Mm-hmm.
That was a horrific thing that happened. A Karban that was brought every day for hundreds of years, nearly a millennium, thank you. Nearly a millennium. So, when it was stopped, that was a terrible, terrible thing. They made sure in the Beis HaMikdash, in order to perpetuate the Karban HaTamid, they always had to have sheep on hand that were checked because you couldn't have a blemish. They had to be sheep that were fit to be used for a Karban. And they always had at least, if I remember correctly, at least 4 days worth of sheep, which is 2 per day. That's 8. A minimum of that amount in the corral of the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash maintained its own, barn or corral for the animals. And they always maintained these sheep. And they're using them every day, so they had to constantly replace sheep. So it was a constant stream of sheep being used for a carbon and then replenishing that stock in the Beis HaMikdash's stables or whatever it is.
These are all male sheep, right?
These would be male. An ola, a totally burnt offering, has to be male. That's right. So that was done. They maintained it. The process of maintaining it is very significant because you can't let it lapse, and it didn't lapse. It was done every single day in the Beis HaMikdash for all those years that it existed, which is remarkable in and of itself. If that sounds like a lot of sheep to you, bear in mind that most slaughterhouses in the United States that are processing meat to eat process far more than that per day in the United States consumer-driven society that we live in. There's a lot more excess than this. But this was done regularly. And this defines the Mizbeach that the sheep were brought every single day. So that's something to bear in mind as well. For next time, I'm debating whether or not to get into the part of the whys now. So if we do that, we'll do that. Otherwise, we will we'll do the last paragraph, which would finish off the parsha, Mitzvah Hashem, next time.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.